When I was a kid, I, for four consecutive years in a row at least, for Halloween.
You turn that off.
I will, yeah. For four consecutive years in a row, I dressed up as Queen Esther for Halloween. She was a hero, and my mom had this beautiful peach floral dress, you know, from very flowy, as I used to call it, you know, from a previous wedding she was in. So it was just kind of a fun. It's really fun to grow up and study one of your childhood heroes. So this was a great treat for me. But yeah, we're going to meet Esther today. We're also going to meet Mordecai. And we're going to look a little bit more into the life of King Xerxes. I'm going to choose to call him Xerxes because I'm still having trouble pronouncing his other name. So just to give a little background, one of the themes throughout the book of Esther is God's providence. So I just wanted to define that word providence for us today to get us on the same page. Providence is God omnisciently or all-knowingly directing the affairs of humankind with wise benevolence. All-knowingly directing the affairs of humankind with wise benevolence. I don't know about you, but when life gets hard and confusing and I'm in the midst of circumstances I don't understand, that's usually my first temptation is to question God's loving, benevolent care for me and his loving hand in all of history. So my prayer today, one of the ways I was encouraged by Esther 2 and my prayer for us all today, is that we will walk away from this passage encouraged that we do have a faithful and providential God who is at work behind the scenes in all of, not only of history, but in the details of our lives. So we're going to start with King Xerxes. He's the first one we come to in chapter 2. We see that he regrets his decision to dismiss Vashti. We read in verse 1 that his anger is abated. Time has gone by. He has actually gone off to war with Greece, and it ended in a devastating defeat. So he is coming back very embarrassed. He has lost a lot of assets for the kingdom. He's also lost a lot of respect from his subjects. So he's not in a very good place. In fact, Herodotus, a Greek historian, records that the king's life was one of sensual overindulgence as a result of his defeat. So this is kind of the platform that Esther is entering in on. It's kind of a sobering place in history with the king. So his house servants, the king's house servants, see him in this state. Now these are different than in chapter 1. In chapter 1 it was his advisors that he was talking with. This was just his common house servants that would wait on him from day to day. They said, "We have a great idea. Let's let beautiful young virgins be brought to you, give them cosmetics and beauty treatments, and whoever pleases the king will be queen instead of Vashti." I taught this last night at the evening Bible study, and one of the ladies said, "It's like our modern day bachelor." You know, if you think about it, I mean, it's all these ladies lining up for this one man. The only difference here is that this was against their will. This was by order of the king. And we see this phrase, when his house servants make this suggestion, we see the phrase, "This pleased the king." This is a repeated phrase throughout chapters 1 and chapter 2. And it really gives us kind of a picture of life in the Persian court. What the king says goes. There's really no authority above him. It pleases the king, so it will be done. So we're getting a bigger picture of the king's lack of character. We see that he is godless. There is no thought of God. He's very indifferent. He's chasing after his desires in the wake of this defeat. He's very whimsical. He's tossed to and fro, first of all, by his emotions. In chapter 1, we saw that he dismissed Vashti because of his anger. And here he is in chapter 2. He's calling all of these young ladies out of loneliness and regret. So he's very whimsical with his emotions. He's also very whimsical and swayed by others' opinions and suggestions. Again, in chapter 1, it was his wise men and advisors who were kind of calling the shots with Queen Vashti, and now it's his common house servants making a suggestion, and he's thinking, "That sounds good to me, let's do it." He's kind of a puppet in some ways, easily persuaded by the opinions of others. As I alluded to before, he's authoritarian. Everyone is at his disposal. Sue said it really well last week. He uses people to promote himself. He's not thinking about anyone else but himself. And if you think about it, you know, he is making the decisions that he's making really affect people in huge life-changing ways. I mean, Queen Vashti was dismissed, and now he's bringing these virgins into his bedroom. They do not leave the same. They're known by a different title. We see before going in verse 8 that they are referred to as women in the charge of Haggai, and after going in the morning, when they come out, they are referred to as concubines in the charge of Sheshgaz. Concubines were recognized as the king's mistresses. They are housed separately. We read it's called the second harem. They have a lower status than his wife, the king's wife or wives, and they will never leave the palace again. They will never be free to marry, and they may never be called on by the king again. It's a seemingly purposeless existence that these ladies are subjected to against their will, and the king just gives no thought. This sounded like a good idea to him, so he's gonna go with it. So we're getting the picture that this is kind of a scary man to have in charge, and this is the stage that Esther is entering. The odds do seem kind of stacked against her and Mordecai at this point. The cool and hopeful part is that we know, as we read further in the story, that he is not the final authority. King Xerxes is not the final authority. Unbeknownst to him, there is a higher authority, our king of all above all kings, who is above him, and he's ordering the events of history right under the king's nose. So that's the hope that we can find. Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He channels it wherever he will." And again in Proverbs 19:21, "Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand." So I couldn't help but think of our presidential election coming up. It's very appropriate. We are going to go out and we're going to vote for the person that we feel will be best suited for this job. But ultimately, no matter who is elected, it will be a fallen person. There is no perfect human being that can fulfill the role of president in a flawless, perfect way. You know, I was just thinking through, they're not going to make perfect decisions. They may even be godless, much like King Xerxes. But what hope we can have that there is an authority that's above our president. He is able, God is able to use even our leaders' sinful and fallen decisions and mistakes for his purposes, much as we see here in the story with King Xerxes. So we can apply this to really any authority that's in our lives, but I thought it was pretty neat that it was happening over this presidential election. But what hope that God is providential over our leaders. So then we meet Mordecai. He's the next one in line, and we're given initially a brief genealogical history. We see that he's the son of Jair, who is the son of Shimei, who is the son of Kish, who is a Benjamite. This is identifying Mordecai with his ancestors. We see that his descendants were the exiles that were carried away from Jerusalem, and that term "carried away" is a pretty important term in this passage. It's actually used three times just in one verse. In verse 6, we see they had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So the author is trying to get us to pay attention that this is a pretty important part of this context. Carried away is a very passive, it's using very passive language, and it's important to note this, because later on when we meet Esther, kind of the similar language is going to be used. So I just wanted to point that out to us. So we're given this short family background on Mordecai, but it's actually pretty significant. This is associating Mordecai with his ancestors, and in so doing it's giving us historical context with which to interpret the rest of this account. We see that he is a Jew living in Susa, which is the Persian capital, and specifically he's living in the citadel, which is where the imperial employees lived. Later on in this chapter, we see him sitting in the king's gate. This term, sitting in the King's Gate, refers to the King's Gate was where justice was decided, because it was kind of the judicial system of the day. This is where officials who were appointed by the king were working. So we see that Mordecai is an official working for the king. The commentators, you know, aren't sure if this was a job given to him after Esther was queen, or if it was given to him before. But either way, the Lord has really placed him in a strategic place throughout this account. I think it's also important to note that Mordecai and Esther are fourth generation exiles. So, going back to Mordecai's ancestry, the historical context that we found him in, his great grandfather was Kish, who was carried away. So he's actually a fourth generation who never knew life in Jerusalem. At this point, some of the Jews had returned to Jerusalem. They were given permission to go back. And honestly, theologians are kind of torn here. Esther and Mordecai, like Daniel, did not return. And some theologians think that they should have, that they should not have been in Persia at this time, and maybe could have avoided some of these things. But others say that Mordecai and Esther alike are kind of a picture of what God commanded in Jeremiah 29 when he said to the exiles, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and have sons and daughters, do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. We actually see Mordecai doing this when at the end of the chapter in verses 19 to 23, he is sitting in the king's gate and he hears of a plot to kill the king. And he alerts the king through Queen Esther. At that point, she's queen. He alerts the king to this plot and saves the king's life. So we see him seeking the welfare of the king and really of the city. And it benefits him. It turns out to his benefit. So he's also raising his orphaned cousin, who is Hadassah, Esther, and he has significant input into Esther's life. When she is taken into the king, he commands her not to make her Jewish heritage known, and she obeys him implicitly. He really, for all intents and purposes, is a father figure to Esther. He's her authority, her guide. He's really helping her make her way through life. We see that he's concerned for Esther's welfare. He checks on her daily in the king's court to see how she was and what was happening to her. And it's pretty interesting. Mordecai and Esther, even in their introduction here, are very intertwined. And throughout the story, they're very intertwined. They're kind of this tag team duo that the Lord uses in tandem. They both have their unique roles, individual roles. But really, the story would not be complete one without the other. But before we go on to meet Esther, I was just really encouraged as I looked at the details surrounding Mordecai's life. Here he is, he's an exile, he's from the Jewish line, he's living in Susa, he has a position in the king's workplace, he has significant input into his adopted cousin whom he's raising. I couldn't help but think these things may have seemed very commonplace to him. This is life as he knew it. He didn't know anything different. But we can see as we continue to see this story play out that these details are not insignificant. The Lord is using these specific things in Mordecai's life for his purposes. And it really made me think about my own life, and really I want all of us to think about our own lives, how God is using the things in our lives that are unique to us. Our history, our background, our experiences, our exiles, the times in life, our sufferings, when we've really suffered, our family, our role in society, those who have influenced us and those that we are influencing, our Esthers. None of these things are wasted. And it's just such a hopeful thought to know that our providential God is at work behind the scenes, using every detail of our lives for his purposes. God is providential over our life experiences and our life circumstances. So finally we meet Esther. She, as we know, was orphaned as being raised by her cousin Mordecai. She respects him as her guardian, as her authority. And then we're given three initial details about her that are kind of interesting. We hear that she is young, she has a beautiful figure, and she's lovely to look at. It's kind of an interesting way to be introduced. not sure how I would feel if that's how Sue introduced me this morning, other than flattered, but, you know, besides that. But it actually is interesting when you come to find out that in Hebrew narrative, the initial details that were given by about a person are actually pretty instrumental to the story itself. So right off the bat, as we're given these details that she's young, beautiful, she's a beautiful figure and beautiful or lovely to look at, these are going to be some pivotal things in the story, which we know is true. So she is the only character to be introduced with both of her names. Her Persian name Esther, meaning star, and her Jewish name Hadassah, meaning myrtle. Leland Ryken actually says, this is the author's way of depicting Esther as a young woman trying to live in two worlds, the Jewish world in which she was raised and the opulent world of the Persian court into which she was thrust. Karen Jobes says, this implies her moving between two worlds. She's a woman with two identities, an issue that will be brought into sharp conflict later in the story. So at this place in chapter 2, it really appears that Esther's kind of going through an identity crisis at this point. When she is taken into the palace to go through all of the beauty treatments and everything, she really blends in, at least to the point where they don't know her Jewish heritage. So she has apparently adopted Persian dress, Persian customs, Persian food. No one knows her identity as a Jew. She goes with the flow. She shows no resistance, which is very unlike Daniel that we just studied not too long ago, who was, you know, Daniel and his friends thrown in the fiery furnace. Daniel was eventually thrown into the lion's den. For not obeying the king, but we don't see that same activity here, that same resistance here with Esther. Ryken sees Esther transformed in this story from a passive and compliant young woman who relies on her beauty to get ahead to a powerful leader of the Jews on whose authority the customs of Purim still stand. It's really not until her people are threatened that we see where her true loyalty lies. But right now in Esther 2, it's kind of, she's trying to figure out where to land. We see that she is taken into the king's palace. Again, this word taken is that same passive language that is used in referring to the exiles, how the exiles were carried away from Jerusalem. So Esther and these young ladies have been taken into the king. You know, commentators, first of all, we get the idea from this passive language that she had no choice in this matter. Commentators point out that to some girls, you know, this would have been an opportunity of a lifetime. And to other girls, this would have been absolutely terrorizing. It's interesting that we are not told how Esther feels about this. But either way, we know by this language that the opinions of the girls were irrelevant. Again, life in the Persian court, what the king says is what goes. Job says this passive voice expresses life from the perspective of being caught up in and swept along by the circumstances beyond one's control. Now, I have to say here that as I was reading through this, I really felt with young Esther at this point. She is a young girl. She's trying to figure out her way in life. To force this on young women at this age is just unthinkable, really. But I thought, haven't we all been in a situation where we've felt swept away, out of control in life with the circumstances of life where we go, how did I get here? You know, how did this happen? I really, you know, just had a moment of feeling with young Esther. But in spite of all of this trauma, in a sense, she begins winning favor with several people. That's another repeated phrase, winning favor. First, she wins favor with Haggai, who's in charge of the women in verse 9. And then she starts winning favor with all who saw her in verse 15. And as a result of this, she's given cosmetics, she's given special food, 7 servants, she's advanced to the best place in the harem. And then eventually, she wins favor with the king himself and is given the crown. She is crowned Queen Esther and is given a feast in her honor. So even in all of the chaos, we see God's hand kind of moving, elevating her to an esteemed position. But let's backtrack and look at the process real briefly for Esther and these women. They were taken to the king's palace. They were given 12 months of preparation, a whole year of perfuming, kind of spa treatments of the day, if you will. Each woman would go in for one night in the king's bed. And this is an undisputed point among theologians, that this night with the king is not just an interview, it's not just, you know, a dinner. This is a night sleeping with the king. It's a pretty sobering thought. She had opportunity, the girls had opportunity to take with them whatever they wanted, anything to help them win the king's approval. So I will let you fill in the blanks with your imagination on that one. They would go in the morning, and they would they would go in the evening, and they would come out in the morning and join the concubines. And again, they would never go in again unless called for by the king. So it's Esther's turn. She's taken into the king in the 10th month of the Jewish calendar, which is the month of Tebeth, so it'd be midwinter. This is the 7th year of the king's reign. So this is 4 years after the events in chapter 1 with Queen Vashti. And we see that she takes in only what is suggested to her by the eunuch, Haggai. And eventually we see that she is actually crowned queen. So take a deep breath with me right now. I don't know about you, but I got real heartburn as I was reading this. I mean, it just is unfathomable to me, you know, when I was reading this. My first thought was, did she know that sleeping with a king was part of the deal? You know, this is pretty traumatic. So the big question that we ask is, why didn't Esther resist, you know, even to the point of death, you know, like Daniel and his friends? It's just a big question mark in our minds. But it relieved me to know, and it should relieve you to know, that we're not the first to ask that question. Commentators have, and theologians have, explored this, and I thought Karen Jobes did a great job of summarizing it when she said, some medieval Jewish interpreters believed that Esther's night with the king was tantamount to forcible rape, and that she could not have reasonably resisted. Others believe that she should have resisted, even if it cost her life. Clearly, her situation was not a simple case of fornication, and permits no simple judgment. So there is mystery here. We are not told, bottom line, no matter our opinions, we are not told how Esther felt about all of this, or Mordecai, for that matter. The author does not condemn or defend Esther or Mordecai for their decisions. We are simply given the details that we need to know. Jobes, again, says it well. She says it's natural to pass judgment on these two, whether positive or negative, but in doing so, we may miss an important point. This deliberate silence is part of the message. Regardless of their character, their motives, or their fidelity to God's law, the decisions that Esther and Mordecai make move the events in some inscrutable way to fulfill the covenant promises that God made to his people long ago. So the purpose of this book of Esther is not to make Esther a hero, much to my chagrin as a 7-year-old child when I'm dressing up as Esther for Halloween. But it's not to show Esther as the hero. The purpose of this book is to show that God is the hero. God is the one at work, in spite of the decisions that sometimes his people make. Whether Esther and Mordecai were right or wrong, God is the hero at work behind the scenes. So this is not an excuse. I want to clarify, this is not an excuse to live faithlessly and to give no thought to our decisions, because we're going to see with Esther and Mordecai later in the story that they do make significant choices, and they do show their loyalty to God and to his people. But instead, my hope as I share this is that it would reassure us that as we do our best to live prayerfully with each decision that comes along and each crossroads we come to, that we can rest, that we have a providential, loving God who is working all things for our good and for his purposes, even in our mistakes, in sins committed against us, when we feel carried away by life, and we're thrust into unwanted circumstances, we have a hope that nothing is haphazard and that God is behind the scenes at work. So just by way of application, you know, we are not so different from Esther. Thankfully, we're not being asked to, you know, be taken into a king's palace, but we too are exiles in this world. The definition of an exile is simply one separated from their country or home. And as followers of Jesus, we are expatriates in this world until we get to heaven, really. In 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 and 2, we read, "For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling." In 1 Peter 2:11, we're referred to as sojourners and exiles in this world. And even our King Jesus felt this tension as he walked the earth, even to the point of death. In John 18:36, we read, Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews to be killed. But my kingdom is not of this world." So here is reality. The reality of life for us as exiles. We all feel this. We are all put into situations where we don't know what to do, and often we are forced to make choices between bad options. It's just a reality for us. And I was thinking through some of these situations where we're forced to make what I like to call exilic decisions. So I'm just gonna make a list, and these are just a beginning. You could add to this, of course. But I was thinking, you know, strained relationships. When do I overlook an offense and absorb and forgive the sin of another? And when do I have a difficult conversation to bring it into the light? It's a hard thing to discern. Again, I alluded to this before, but voting for a president, making a choice between the faults of imperfect leaders, really. Often we feel that instead of asking who's best, we're forced to ask who's not as bad. What about showing the gospel to unbelieving neighbors and friends? When do I speak the truth, and when do I listen to simply understand their perspective? This line is not clear-cut. How about time management? When do I say no to requests for my time in order to maintain healthy margin? And when do I sacrifice my margin to serve and to take steps of faith? How about navigating medical options? When we are required to make difficult medical decisions, weighing the pros and the cons, and sometimes we have very little understanding of the ramifications that will affect either our life or the life of our loved one, for better or for worse. And finally, the last one I thought of that I deal with every day is parenting. How do you discipline your kids with their heart and mind, searching for that balance of grace and truth? When do you speak? When do you listen? And even as they grow older and become more independent, when do you let them make their own choices and feel consequences for their mistakes and for their bad choices? And when do you intervene? All of these things are really not clear cut. There's no clear cut line. And honestly, one Christian's decision in one of these situations may not match another Christian's decision. But the point of chapter 2 and the hope, my prayer for all of us today, is that we will walk away with great comfort and great hope in this account. That in the details of life, there is a sovereign, providential, loving God that is very intimately involved. We find great comfort in the words of a loved verse, Romans 8:28. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. And you know, I hesitated to use such a well-loved and often used verse because I feel like sometimes it can just be slapped on suffering as a band-aid, and that was not my intent here this morning. But I felt like, you know, in the context of Esther and Mordecai and even King Xerxes, it just was such a clear, kind of made it pop off the page. It was such a clear picture. And we do know, you know, we just finished studying Lamentations. We know that there's a time to lament The Bible gives us that freedom. There's a time to grieve suffering. So in no way, you know, do we want to just slap Romans 8:28 on suffering. But it really did kind of pop off the page in the context of this account. So we rest in this hope that even when we feel swept away, when life feels out of control, when God seems hidden, which oddly enough in the book of Esther to the common reader, looking at the pages, his name is never mentioned. So he can appear hidden in this story, but we can see as the events unfold that he is at work, and we find great hope that he is also working all the details of our lives individually and in history together for his perfect purposes. May the Lord make us women who say with David in Psalm 31, I trust in you, O Lord. You are my God. My times are in your hand. Let's pray. Father, we do just give you such praise and such thanks for the hope and the comfort that you give us through your word, through Esther and Mordecai, and even oddly enough, through King Xerxes. Thank you for your hand that is always intimately involved, lovingly directing the events of our lives for your purposes and for our good. Lord, it just really is a comfort to rest there. Lord, we do pray that you would make us women that can say, we trust in you, O Lord. You are our God. Our times are in your hand. We're just so thankful for the direction, comfort, and peace that you give.